I'm sure I'll be doing this differently from how Kim does it, but that's okay. This, I'll post this recording on my announcements page, by the way. We are into the skeleton. It's a 2-week process. You'll have your practicum in a little less than 2 weeks, right? You'll be hopefully about half done in 2 weeks from now. And doing the skeleton in 2 weeks makes sense not only because there's a lot of information, but because the skeleton has two major components to it. What are those two parts of the skeleton? Yeah, the axial skeleton and the appendicular skeleton. So we're doing the axial today, and anything that's, you know, like in these boxes that has partly appendicular stuff, ignore all the appendicular stuff today. Axial skeleton and appendicular skeleton. So the axial skeleton gets its name because it forms the axis of the body. It's along the midline. Whereas the appendicular skeleton gets its name because it includes everything that is appended onto that axis. It includes the appendages, which means that they are added on. So what is included in the axial skeleton? Well, you have the bones of the head, right? Which is more than just the skull. Skull is most of the bones of the head, but you also have in the middle ear, in each of the two middle ears, I should say, auditory ossicles. So there's three pairs of auditory ossicles, malleus, incus, and stapes, by far the smallest of the human bones, that they're in the head, but they're not really part of the skull. So they're included, along with the skull. You also have the vertebral column, which consists of a series of individual vertebrae, but then also some fused vertebrae on the inferior end. You have sacrum and coccyx, which start out as individual bones, but then fuse together. Five bones form the sacrum. It's considered now one bone. So those are all included as well. Anything else? The sternum is included, correct? We're still not done, though.
Collarbone?
No, the collarbones and the scapulae are part of the pectoral girdle. The two girdles, pectoral and pelvic, are part of the appendicular skeleton. But there's still stuff along the midline. All the ribs. False and true. Yeah, the ribs are part of the axial skeleton. And probably the one that's easiest to overlook is the hyoid bone. Hyoid means U-shaped, and you'll see when you look at it in isolation that it's shaped like a U. On articulated skeletons, it's usually just wired in place where it occurs in a living human, but it's not actually connecting to any other bone. That's its claim to fame. It does not articulate. It's just held in place by the soft tissues that are connected to it. So it's a stabilizing place, but it doesn't form an articulation. And the hyoid is included in that axial skeleton as well. So you really just have a bunch of stuff to look at and memorize today. I'm not going to stand up here and exhaustively go through the whole list and point to everything, because we'll be here for a long time, for one thing. But also, I don't think that's really productive. You can get just as much information from a picture pointing to it than you can me pointing it out. But I do want to talk about a couple things, including some specific bones of the skull and some things about the vertebrae. But more generally, I want to say a couple things, too. Now that we're into the skeleton, you'll probably notice that what has changed from previous weeks is that the list of terms that you have to know drastically increases. It's quite a list now compared to the... You didn't have all that much to memorize before. You had a lot to look at, but not all that many terms to memorize. And these are not ordinary words that you use every day. They're kind of weird words. And so, since there's a lot of them and you have to learn them one way or another, there's two ways you could go about that: the wrong way and the right way, or the hard way and the and the easier way, the not as hard way. If you approach, as a lot of students do, these words as though they don't have any meaning, like they're just random strings of letters, then that will be a lot more work for you. It's completely analogous to trying to memorize telephone numbers that don't have any meaning, right? They're just random strings of numerals. So if you had 150 telephone numbers to memorize, it would be a bitch. Well, the advantage of words is that they actually have meanings, and if you can and learn what those roots mean and put meanings to the words, it's going to be a lot easier to learn them to begin with, and much, much easier to remember them. They make sense. They're named for good reason in almost all cases. Okay, so you have to put the work into memorizing something anyway. If you can memorize word roots, it'll be a lot more efficient because the word roots are used over and over. All right? Now, there are some general words that keep popping up in the skeleton, not only axial but appendicular as well. For instance, process is a general word. And I've talked about processes in lecture, right? Cell processes are what I've talked about, like microvilli, or the cell processes that stick out from the main part of an osteocyte and extend halfway down a canaliculus. That's a cell process. It's called a process because it processes. It sticks out from the main part. Well, there are bony processes as well, some of which are actually called processes, some of them aren't. They get other names still. But there are all kinds of processes, and they have a two-part name usually because there's some descriptive word that comes before the word process. We can't call all of them processes and know where we are on the skeleton. But there are plenty of examples of processes. And specific examples of processes that actually get other names besides process are condyles, for instance. That's another word that is used over and over in different bones. It's something I actually mentioned yesterday in lecture. Does anyone remember what condyle means? Knuckle, yes. Not referring to the knuckles in your fingers, but knuckle is a bulbous process. And condyles, so they are processes, but in this case we call them condyles because they are specifically processes that have a very smooth surface. And the reason they have a smooth surface is because they are involved in highly movable articulations. So they are the surface that articulates with another bone in a diarthrosis. And therefore they need to be friction-free or as non-friction as possible. Okay, so condyles you'll find on many different bones. But you shouldn't confuse that with epicondyles, which is another specific type of process, bony process. Epicondyles are not condyles. They're kind of the opposite. Condyles are always smooth because of the articulation. Epicondyles are always rough. They're a rough bump on a bone. They're called epicondyles simply because they're located near condyles, epi meaning over, just like epidermis is over the dermis. But epicondyles are rough surfaces because that provides a lot of little openings, little nooks and crannies for tendons to grow in there, which is what epicondyles are. They're sites for attachment of tendons or ligaments. There are also several different terms used for spaces, which aren't actually structures, but they get names. Just like a lacuna or a canaliculus, not really a structure, right? It's just a space, but we name it anyway. And there's different kinds of spaces on bones. One example is a fossa, F-O-S-S-A. There are all kinds of fossae with specific names depending on which bone they're on. Some bones have several fossae. Why do we call them that? Anyone know what the root there is? Or what similar words include the root that fossa has? Fossil. What are fossils? I mean, why do we call fossils fossils? Why do we call fossil fuel fossil fuels? Not because they're made out of fossils. What did you say? Well, the fact that they're fuels means they are storing energy. But why are they fossil fuels? Sunlight, for instance, is an energy source, but it's not fossil. Why do we call animals fossorial, some animals, fossorial animals? What does that mean? No, fossorial animals are ones that dig burrows. Fossil fuels are ones that we dig up. Fossils are buried. And so fossa means dug. And so when you have a fossa, usually what it looks like on a bone is a shallow depression, like someone scraped a little bit of the bone out of the surface. That's why it's called that. It's not all the way through, though. It doesn't pierce through the bone. It's not a hole, in other words. It's just a depression. There are specific words for holes that go all the way through. For instance, foramen is a word, general word. There are all kinds of foramina, which is the plural of foramen. That is a hole all the way through the bone, so you can see through it. It's not the only thing that is, it's the only name that we use for a hole through a bone, though. We also sometimes use the word canal. And the difference, really, between a canal and a fossa, first of all, it's up to the person who originally names it, largely, but usually a canal goes through a thicker portion of bone than a fossa does. Fossa is more like a window in a wall, a fairly thin wall, whereas a canal goes through a deep part and might take turns as it goes, so you might not actually see the daylight through it, but it is a passageway all the way through. And then there are fissures as well, all kinds of different fissures. Like in the skull, if you look in an orbit, why are these things called orbits, the eye sockets? They're called orbits because they house the orbs. Orb means sphere. The spheres are the eyeballs. So in the orbit anyway, you can see two major cracks. Those are fissures, which is all that fissure means, right? Crack. Superior orbital fissure, inferior orbital fissure. Very descriptive. Still another word for a space is meatus, which are the ear holes. Acoustic meati, internal and external. A meatus is a passageway as well. Okay, so it's important to learn the general terms because they're used over and over. But then when those general terms get specified by an adjective that comes before them, make sense of that adjective. Think about why it's actually called that. Sometimes it's named for the bone it's on. Sometimes it's named for something it looks like. Sometimes it's named for some other bone that it's close to or connects to. Let me go through the bones of the skull quickly. Because the skull of the axial skeleton, the skull usually takes the most time to learn, gives people the most trouble, simply because there's a lot of bones in a small place, I think. And they're weirdly shaped bones. So weirdly shaped bones have a bunch of features to them compared to just the femur doesn't have all that many features because it's just a stick, basically. But the more complex a shape is, the more opportunity you have to give little pieces individual names. And so that's largely why the list is long, because you not only have to know all the names of the bones, which there are how many in the skeleton, by the way? 206 in an adult human skeleton. But you also have to know in a lot of cases of individual bones, specific names of features on those bones. So it makes the list longer. Anyway, as I said in class, or in lecture, the skull itself has two major components. What are those? The face and the cranium. Correct. The cranium is defined as the brain case, but I mean, what makes the cranial bones cranial is that all of them are in contact with the brain. None of the facial bones are in contact with the brain. Instead, the facial bones just hang on the cranium. Now, there are 8 cranial bones, 14 facial bones that hang on that cranium. All right, so a total of 22 skull bones. And those skull bones, like other bones of the skeleton, can be either paired or unpaired. So there might be a left-right version of it, or there might just be one. And hopefully it makes sense that if it is an unpaired bone, you're going to find it medially placed, right? It's going to straddle the midline because of our symmetry. You're not going to find an unpaired bone just on one side of the body. So, for instance, on the brain case, each of the tables has one of these little colored ones, which we just got. They're obviously scaled down in size. This is the true size of a human skull. This one's smaller. But I wanted to get these because we don't have the full-size colored ones. And it's good to have the colored ones as a supplement because each bone is its own color, and therefore you can see where bones start and end, which can be difficult on a skull because the joints are so tight, the sutures. So anyway, by the way, these things do come apart, but don't take them apart. Because the more they get taken apart, the less they stay together from then on. And we don't really need to take them apart. You can take the lid off the full-size skull and see a bunch of stuff inside. But the cranium consists of 8 bones, like I said. On the very back, you have the occipital bone, the green one on this model. Occiput means back of the neck, basically. So that's why it's called the occipital bone. That's an example of an unpaired one. You also have an unpaired one in the front, descriptively called the frontal bone. By the way, it's one frontal bone in adults, but this is another example of 2 bones that eventually fuse together. So in early development, it starts out as left and right frontal bones. They fuse together and become one bone. So in an adult, therefore, what would we classify that joint as? Between what were the left and right halves. Based on your extensive study of yesterday's lecture, it would be an example of a synostosis, a bony joint. Okay? So that's 2. Front and back is 2. Then you have paired bones on the sides, called parietal bones, because parietal means like a wall. They're forming the side walls of the cranium. All right? That's 4. You also have temporal bones, one on either side. And what does the word temporal mean in everyday life? What is it?
Not permanent.
Well, it temporary means, which has the same root, means not permanent. Temporal means having to do with time, as opposed to spatial, which has to do with space. All right? So we call these bones the temporal bones, and we call this part of the body the temples, same root, because, especially in male humans, this area, the sideburns, are what usually go gray first. Gives you an indication of the passage of time. So those are the temples, these are the temporal bones. All right, that's 6. That leaves only 2. And the other 2 are harder to see from where you're sitting. But if you look through the nasal cavity, toward the top of that nasal cavity, you see a greenish bone. And that's called the ethmoid bone. If you take the lid off the full-size skull, this area right here is the top of the ethmoid bone. And by the way, be sure to look at the pictures in the manual of isolated skull bones. Those are important. Anyway, it's called the ethmoid bone. It's about the size and the shape of a walnut. And it's called ethmoid for a reason, of course. The oid ending always means that it's like something, right? So the beginning part of that word means sieve. Ethmoid means sieve-like. Well, what is a sieve? Anyone know what a sieve is? Yeah, it's a filter, basically. Right? It's like a colander. So a sieve, in other words, is full of holes. Hence the not too complimentary comment. Person has a mind like a sieve. Nothing stays in it. So ethmoid means sieve-like, full of holes. You don't really see it too well on this plastic model, but if you were to look at a real skull, the top view of this ethmoid bone, the ethmoid has a horizontally placed shelf on it called the cribriform plate. Cribriform is another word that really just means sieve-like. So cribriform and ethmoid mean the same thing, but that cribriform plate of the ethmoid bone is perforated, has a bunch of foramina in it, little passageways. So that's what makes it sieve-like in appearance. The passageways, those foramina, are called olfactory foramina because they're passageways for the olfactory nerve to get through there and reach the brain, because there are nerve endings in the nasal cavity, which is what allows you to detect the odorants that you smell. The nerve has to get to the brain, which is in the brain case, so it has to get through bone to do that. Another part of the ethmoid, by the way, is a little kind of shark fin looking piece. And it's another process that sticks straight up on the midline. That one's called the crista galli. Anyone have any idea what that means? What does gallus mean? Or gallo? Chicken. Chickens are galliforms. Crista galli means rooster's crest, because it looked to whoever named it like the crest on a rooster's head. Sticks right up on the midline. Thin. All right, so that's seven. And then that leaves only one more for the cranium, which, if you open the jaw of the colored one and look at it through this direction, you see this bluish bone that you can see also on the sides a little bit. That's the bottom view of it. The top view from the one with the lid off would be this region right here. That's called the sphenoid bone. Once again, the oid ending, so it means it's like something. Sphenoid means wedge-like, but if you look at the picture of the isolated sphenoid, it doesn't really look like a wedge. It's kind of an indirect naming. It's called wedge-like because the sphenoid is said to be the keystone of the cranium. So what is a keystone? Key what? Well, there are keystone species named for the same reason, but originally, what is a keystone? It is an actual stone. In masonry, the keystone holds everything in place. The keystone is the middle stone at the top of an arch, shaped like a wedge. You know, the logo of Pennsylvania, the Keystone State, is that keystone shape. It's called the keystone because if you don't have it, the entire thing topples. The sphenoid is called the keystone of the cranium because all the other seven of the eight cranial bones attach directly to the sphenoid. So the sphenoid holds the entire cranium together. And it's not really that it's wedge-shaped, but since it's called the keystone of the cranium, they gave it a name that means wedge-like or keystone-like sphenoid. All right, that's the cranium. Let's quickly go through the face. The facial bones are also, some of them are paired, some of them are unpaired. You have two nasal bones here, right where you'd think nasal bones are, at the nose. The jaw is made up of three bones, like I was talking about in lecture. A single mandible, but remember, that's another example of a synostosis that forms between what start out as right and left mandibles. But it's just one mandible in the lower part of the jaw. The upper part of the jaw throughout life, though, remains two. Each one is a maxilla. So there are two maxillae. You have zygomatic bones on either side of the cheek. I mean, at the cheeks. The ones you can easily feel through your skin. These are the zygomatic bones. And by the way, that word, zygomatic, has the same root in it as zygote. Another word from biology. A zygote is formed when sperm and egg unite, right? Fertilization. Zygo means yolk, not Y-O-L-K, Y-O-K-E. What is a yolk? In a sense, a yoke is a bar that you tie to oxen together, for instance, so that they can pull your cart. So a yoke is something that binds things together. And that's why a zygote is called that, because you combine the egg and the sperm to make it. This is called the zygomatic bone, because we have this zygomatic arch that the zygomatic bone forms part of. The zygomatic arch is a bar that looks like a yoke, a true oxen yoke. All right? And here's where you have to be careful. One example of how you have to be careful with terminology. The zygomatic arch is not the entire bone or the entire two bones. There are parts of two bones involved. The yellow part and the purple part make up the arch itself, but not the rest of the yellow and not the rest of the purple. Just this bar-like form. That's the zygomatic arch. It's formed by two processes. One that's a process of one bone, and the other is a process of the other bone. But these processes on each of these two bones are named not for the bone they're part of, but for the bone that they connect to. So this yellow part of the zygomatic arch is called the zygomatic process of the temporal bone. And the purple part of the same zygomatic arch is called the temporal process of the zygomatic bone. Now that actually it seems confusing, but that makes sense. You wouldn't want to call this yellow part the temporal process and name it for the bone it's part of, because that's not the only process on the temporal bone. For instance, you have this one, which is also a process. That's called the mastoid process. What does mastoid mean, by the way? Well, like something, right? But what does mast mean?
Chewing?
No. Although it's... I see why you say that based on where it is. Well, what is a mastectomy? Breast removal, right? Mast means breast. Mastoid means breast-like. That's a breast-like protuberance or bump. So that's also a process of the temporal bone. So it wouldn't make sense to call this just the temporal process. It does make sense to call it the zygomatic process, because it's the only one of the temporal processes that connect to the zygomatic bone. Okay, so we haven't finished the face yet. There's also, even though they're not listed on this cheap model, they're small, there's just really not enough room. There are lacrimal bones right here, paired lacrimal bones, here and here. What does lacrimation mean? That's a process. I mean, it's a other use of the word process, meaning something that's being performed. What is lacrimation? Anyone know? Tearing, crying. Yeah. To lacrimate means to cry. So the lacrimal bones are named for the fact that that's where the tears collect. Right on the midline, you also have in this version, it's one of the many shades of green that they used. But you see part the back of it right here, right on the midline, and it's a very thin. It doesn't really go on right or left very far. It's very thin, right on the midline. And if you look at it in profile, it would start out wide in the back of the bone, and then it would travel down and come to a point right in the nasal cavity. So this ridge that you see right here on the nasal cavity, that's that bone getting more and more pointed as it comes forward. Well, this thing is called the vomer, which means plow, because the whole thing is shaped like an old-fashioned plow blade that your yoked oxen might pull through the field for you. You also have a couple of nasal conchae, inferior nasal conchae, as they're called. Concha, which is the singular, means shell. That's why they were named that. But those are in here. Those are also not on this version listed. You have palatine bones as well, which are also not colored on this one. But palatine bones are toward the back of the roof of the mouth. They form the hard palate. And I don't think I forgot any, but if so, they're on your list. All right, that's the skull. Let's talk a little bit about vertebrae before I let you loose on looking at stuff. How many individual vertebrae are the ones that stay as individual vertebrae? How many are those? Anyone know? Yeah, go ahead and guess. One of you is right. 24 is right. Yeah, when I was talking about fibrocartilage pads called intervertebral discs, there are 23 of those. But the reason there are 23 is because there's 23 spaces between 24 items. There's 24 vertebrae. And those 24 vertebrae that are individual still are arranged superior to inferior into three groups. There's three categories of those vertebrae. What's the superior-most category of vertebrae? The cervical vertebrae, correct. Cervical is the adjective form of cervix. What does cervix mean? Neck. It means a narrowing between two bigger pieces. So this is a cervix. But also the narrowing of the uterus is called the cervix, the uterine cervix, for the same reason. And so the cervical vertebrae come in, there are how many of them? There are seven. We refer to vertebrae alphanumerically. So the seven cervical vertebrae are called C1 through C7, with C1 being the superior one, C7 being the inferior one. In addition to those alphanumeric monikers, there are also special names that we give to just C1 and C2. What is C1 called? Well, it is a cervical vertebra, but we give C1 its own special name. No? Atlas, yes. I'm trying to find an atlas. C1 is called the atlas. What about C2? This is C1, by the way. That's the atlas. This is C2, which also gets its special name. That's called the axis. The rest of them are just C3 through C7. Let me explain why we call them that. First, though, notice that any given vertebra has on it a weight-bearing part, which we call the body. That's where the intervertebral discs are, the fibrocartilage pads between adjacent vertebrae. Okay, and as you descend the spinal column, the bodies get bigger and bigger because they're bearing more and more weight the farther you go down. At the same time, this hole, which is called a vertebral foramen, which is the passageway for the spinal cord, those get smaller and smaller as you go down because the spinal cord gets narrower and narrower as spinal nerves come off of it on the way down. But one claim to fame of the atlas, which is this one, is that it does not have a body. It's the only vertebra that does not have a body. It's more like a ring. Why is it called atlas, though? It's taken from mythology. What did Atlas do? No? Hold up the world, hold up the earth, the globe. Well, the globe that this bone is holding up is the skull. That's why it's called the atlas. So the occipital condyles of the occipital bone of the cranium rock in these little depressions called articular facets on the atlas. And that allows for the yes motion with your head, nodding. The axis is so called because it provides an axis of rotation between the atlas and axis. And it does that because of what forms the actual axle, or the axis, is this tooth-like process that sticks upward. This is called the dens. What does dens mean? Well, the adjective is dental. So what does dens mean? Tooth. Yeah, that's why I called it a tooth-like projection. So that dens of the axis is the swivel point between axis and atlas, and there's in life there is a ligament that wraps around the other side to keep it in place. That allows for the no motion. So when you're doing this, that's not between the skull and a bone, it's between the atlas and the axis. Okay, so 7 cervical vertebrae. What's the next section down? Thoracic vertebrae. They are in the thorax. What is the hallmark of thoracic vertebrae? Other than they are in the thorax. What makes them different from the other vertebrae? They are the vertebrae that connect to or articulate with ribs. Okay? There are how many pairs of ribs in a human? Any idea? Keep going. 12. Yeah, there are 12 pairs of ribs. Because you include all ribs, not just the ribs that connect at both ends. So this is a rib still too. 1 through 12, and you have right and left version. Therefore, there are 12 thoracic vertebrae that connect to those ribs. All right? Lower still, you have the third category, which is what? The lumbar vertebrae, exactly. And those are the ones that have the largest bodies, because by then you're carrying more and more weight on each of those vertebrae. So if you were to have an isolated vertebra in front of you and you were asked to put it into one of those three categories, the correct category, you should really approach this by asking yourself a question first, which is, does this vertebra have transverse foramina? Let me explain, first of all, what a transverse process is. Any given vertebra has processes on it. This is called the spinous process that sticks backward or posteriorly. Spinous because it is spiny, it's sharp. But the ones on the sides, right and left, are called transverse processes. All right? On a cervical vertebra, which also has transverse processes, you'll find holes, a hole in each transverse process, and therefore those are called transverse foramina. Okay? Only the cervical vertebrae have transverse foramina. Moreover, all 7 of them have transverse foramina. They have them because they're passageways for vertebral arteries, which are important arteries that need to be encased in their own little piece of bone. The other vertebrae do not have that. So that's why that should be your first question. Does this vertebra have vertebral foramina? I mean, transverse foramina? If a yes, you definitely are looking at a cervical vertebra. If the answer is no, then all you can do is rule out cervical, and you have to decide whether it's thoracic or lumbar. Now, thoracic, only the thoracic, have little demifacets, as they're called, which are the connection points with the ribs. But those demifacets can be hard to find, especially on a real bone, or actually even harder to find on a model bone. So even though that's a definitive way of saying that it's thoracic versus lumbar, there's actually a more useful way of making that distinction. I'll show you what I mean. This is a thoracic, and this is a lumbar. You don't want to go by size, even though the lumbar are bigger in general. If you're comparing T12, the lowest of the thoracics, with L1, they're almost the same size, so that's not so reliable. I think the best way for most people to make that distinction is to notice that cervical vertebrae look like giraffe heads. You see that? Whereas lumbar vertebrae look like moose heads. Fairly convincingly. So use that. And but make your first question whether it has transverse foramina or not. Okay, I've probably spoken enough, so you have plenty of other things I didn't mention to look at, but go ahead and start looking. Oh, I'm going to put up the text.